The scripture from today, or for today, comes first from Ephesians chapter 4, verses 25 through 27. Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are all members of one body. In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Also, we have Mark chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. Another time he went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal them on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath? To do good or to do evil, to save a life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus.
We are in a series on the seven deadly sins, or seven cardinal sins. We come today to the vice of anger. And if you've been with us for this series, we've typically been breaking it up into two sermons with a spiritual practice in the middle. I want to do things a little bit different this week. I'm going to just do one sermon. And the reason I want to do this is because anger is a little tricky. So I think we all would say it certainly can be a vice. I think we recognize that anger can be a source of great evil. But the thing about anger is it also can be a source of great good. So one of the things, if you've been with us, we've been talking about as we've been looking at these vices, these deadly sins, is that at their roots, at their core, there are good things there. There are good desires behind basically each one of these things. And what happens is that along the way, these good desires go awry. They get twisted. These good loves become, as we've said, disoriented. And so, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we talked about the vice of lust. So lust comes out of the good desire for sex, to unite ourselves with another person. Lust goes awry when it morphs into treating another person as an object, when they are used as an instrument for our pleasure. So as I tried to kind of encapsulate in a sentence, lust wants it. Lust doesn't care about the beloved person behind it. And so I kind of want to actually kind of flip things around a little bit today and maybe talk about the potential good of anger before we move into how it goes awry. And our first passage from today that Elizabeth read is from the book of Ephesians, and it comes within this larger section of Paul contrasting the new life in Christ with the old life before they had come into Christ. So he writes, "You were taught with regards to your former life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desire, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self." And then he continues just a few verses later, and he writes, "In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold." Which I think, probably when you saw that verse, I think it looks pretty self-evident. It's pretty obvious that if anger can be a problem, anger is the way the devil can use it as a foothold. But I like the NIV. I mostly read the NIV translation, but the NIV does not have the best translation here for this. And it's really, I think, important to see this. So will you put up that first slide, Larry? So we've got the NIV, which you would have heard, "In your anger, do not sin," which actually comes from a psalm. King James and NRSV have a much more literal translation, I think a much better. "Be ye angry and sin not." Or the NRSV, "Be angry, but do not sin." You see the difference here? On the second two, there's actually a command. It's an imperative in Greek. "Be angry, but don't sin." You can take that off, Larry. Thanks. Meaning that not only is it possible to be angry and not sin, but at least in some way, we seem to be commanded to be angry, which is kind of weird, which is kind of strange. Now, we obviously need to see this within the context of what the New Testament teaches on anger. Numerous passages in James, here later on in this passage, where we are told to get rid of anger and rage. But I want you to hang with me just for a little bit, because this is something I think we don't always think about, of this command to be angry. So one of the best places we can see this worked out is in the life of Jesus. And as we read in the passage in Mark, Jesus moves into a synagogue, and it's the Sabbath, which means it's a day of refreshment. It's a day for spiritual and physical and mental restoration. In other words, it's a day that's supposed to be life-giving. And Jesus sees this man with a shriveled hand, and so do the Pharisees. But they really are seeing two different things. So when Jesus looks at this man with a shriveled hand, he sees an opportunity to do good, to give life, to act with compassion towards this man. The Pharisees in the synagogue, they see the exact same men, but they see something very different. They don't see this man who's had this shriveled life for maybe his whole life. They see the possibility to trap Jesus. So Jesus knows what's happening, and he kind of moves this towards a showdown. He calls the man with the shriveled hand to stand up, and he does that, and he asks this question. Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or do evil, to save life or to kill? So according to the Jewish law on the Sabbath, you were allowed to save a life, meaning if someone was going to die unless you acted, you were given permission to act. So technically, yes, I think the Pharisees would say, yeah, you can save a life on the Sabbath. But do good is kind of vague. Like, that would not have fit well with their legal minds, because good is hard to kind of nail down. And so this man with a shriveled hand, like, the reality is he's probably had it for a long time. And they would say, well, you just need to wait another day. Heal this guy, but wait till Sunday. Their Sabbath would have been on Saturday. And so Jesus asked this question, and this is kind of what's happening in this context, and the Pharisees say nothing. And when Jesus sees this, if you notice, Jesus gets angry. He gets angry because for these Pharisees, the rules surrounding Sabbath have now become more important than the person right in front of them. They have turned this day of refreshment, this day that was intended for good, into a weapon. And it makes Jesus angry. Not just angry, it deeply distresses him. He seems to be angry at the way they're treating this man, but he's also angry at the hardness of their hearts that won't allow the love of God to work. So let's just stop here for a second, because I want to just kind of hold this image of Jesus as angry in our minds. I don't want to speak for everyone, but that's not my go-to image of Jesus. I mean, we do have the scene of Jesus in the temple, very famous scene of Jesus flipping over tables. He's driving out the livestock with a whip, driving out the money changers. I think if you ask, does Jesus get angry, that would probably be the first thing that pops most in our mind. This story doesn't typically pop in my mind. In fact, I just read this with my kids a week ago, and I didn't notice this at all. So what comes in our mind when we think about Jesus? Loving, nurturing, gentle, kind. I mean, often, I think nowadays, we think about the softer sides of Jesus, the one who welcomes children. I noticed a painting in the back of the church with Jesus, very warm, welcoming the children. We think about Jesus talking about the lilies in the field. So, absolutely, that is who Jesus was. Like, that is a beautiful and compelling side of Jesus. But you got to remember, Jesus got killed. And Jesus got killed because he was seen as a threat. And people who talk to children and welcome children and talk about lilies in the field are not usually seen as threats to the state. So Jesus was loving, he was nurturing, he was tender. He was also passionate and emotional. He got angry, he wept, he yelled out kind of a wild fashion from the cross. Jesus challenged societal structures. He was seen as a rebel and a threat. And in fact, what we read in that passage is right after this happens, they begin on the Sabbath again to plot Jesus' demise. How are they going to kill Jesus? My point is, Jesus was not a passionless, apathetic man. He experienced the full spectrum of human emotion, including angry, which I think we just need to hold that just for a little bit. Like I said, we obviously need to see this within the wider context of who Jesus is and the teachings on anger. But we are not called as Christians to be stoics. Like, we might be called to be, we are called to be pacifists, but we are far from passive as followers of Jesus. And I was thinking about, like, when I took a class on Anabaptist history, you know, often we talk about ourselves as the quiet in the land, right? This kind of time where Mennonites were persecuted and they went out and looked for a peaceful place. Important part of Mennonite history. But I was struck by how wild some of these early Anabaptists were. These were not the quiet in the land. These were men and women of zeal. They were passionate evangelists. They were just, like I said, some of them were kind of wild. Not who I think as in our Mennonite identity we think of, and yet these were the first Mennonite Anabaptists. So I just want to hold that, and that we need to make sure we are holding the whole spectrum of Jesus in our minds. Yes, he was all these softer sides, and we connect with that, maybe some more than others. Some of us might really connect with this other side of Jesus that is pretty, a little bit wild. And I want to say, I think that's okay. So Paul commands us to be angry. Jesus gives us the example of anger. So what does this mean for us? Well, I want us to just start by thinking about, kind of just thinking together what anger is. And it provides a really interesting contrast to sloth, which we talked about last week. So I mentioned sloth is cool-blooded. Like, you don't even recognize sloth as at work because it's kind of snuck up beside you. It's quietly taken its place next to you. And it begins to do its destruction, but very slowly, silently, patiently. So the way sloth works, and if you weren't here, we talked about sloth as basically spiritual laziness. It ebbs away, fades slowly. It snuffs out the fire, the passion for God. Anger is very different. Anger is hot-blooded. Anger is very self-evident. You can literally feel the anger pulsating in your bodies, right? Your heart begins to race. You feel the adrenaline start pumping. To other people outside of you, it becomes very evident. The color in your face changes. The pupils in your eyes often dilate. Your voice changes. And what is often, this is what I think is important about just trying to like peel back, because I think we know what anger feels like, but what is happening is that at that moment, we're recognizing that something is not right. Something unjust is happening. And this is exactly what we see in this story about Jesus and the story of Mark. Jesus sees an injustice. He sees the way that rules that were meant to give life are now being turned into weapons against life. And so what often prompts our anger is the recognition that something is wrong. Something is not as it is meant to be. And this is where it gets a little bit harder to understand, but I want to try to explain is that anger recognizes the wrong, but then it often seeks out to right that wrong. So one thing that was helpful to me is kind of the thinking about trying to destroy an obstacle. So this is not like usually a literal obstacle with anger, but what anger does is it identifies an obstacle, this kind of injustice is happening, and that obstacle is keeping the good from happening. So what anger does is it seeks to destroy that obstacle. It's this kind of destructive energy. And so let's think about this story in Mark. What's the good? Well, for Jesus, the good is that this man will be healed. This man that suffered from a shriveled hand, the good is that he will be healed. What's stopping that? What's stopping that is the hardness of heart of the Pharisees. And so when Jesus recognizes injustice and he sees the obstacle, he seeks to destroy that obstacle. He opens up the way for healing. And so just think back. We probably don't have a whole lot of time to just rest in it, but think about the last time you just got really mad. I don't think this is with all cases of anger, but very often if you kind of just sit there and reflect, someone has kind of come in or something has blocked something that you wanted. So they are keeping you, what they've done or what they're doing is keeping you from getting to what you think is good. And what you often do with your anger is you seek to obliterate that obstacle, to remove it so that you can get to the good. And this is where anger gets tricky because, like I said, sometimes anger is for the injustice that's being done to someone else. It's what we'd call probably righteous anger. It gets really hard, though, to figure out kind of where is the righteous anger and where is the selfish anger. And I think about this because I, as a parent, there are times where I get angry with my kids. Sometimes that anger is at a very good, it's good, there's a good reason behind it. So the child has disobeyed, the child has done something that possibly is harmful to them, they've lied, so this is a barrier to kind of the development of their character. But other times it's not. So other times, like I've had a long day and the kids are in bed and I've been waiting all day for this moment to just relax, and the parents will know what happens, just like an eruption from upstairs. Like, I hope I'm not making your blood pressure go up. This happens in our house a lot. And often what it sends me off is, in anger, the obstacle between my peace the obstacle that's keeping me from my peace is this yelling, and I seek with my anger to destroy it. Not literally destroy it, but destroy the yelling in however way is possible. But here's my point. At the end of the day, this is really a pretty selfish anger. So at this point, I've lashed out at my children because the injustice has been done to me. And so my point here is that anger, again, is not an inherently bad thing, but where it often goes wrong is where the fight is for one's own selfish cause, not for justice. So anger is a huge motivator. It propels us to fight against injustice. It is, in what some people would say, a holy emotion. And yet, also at the same time, it can be a hellish emotion. It can bring out the best in us, and it can bring out the worst in us. I think I mentioned that anger, in some ways, is like a flame. So you think about when that flame is set loose in an uncontrolled manner, it can scorch the earth. It can make you act in ways and say things that will leave scars for a long time. And the best thing about anger is that it doesn't take long for an outburst of anger to have effects that linger for years and years, perhaps even a lifetime. Some things will never be forgotten that were spoken in anger. Which is why Paul says, be angry, don't sin. Because it's so easy for that anger, even if it's in good intention, to quickly devolve into sin. I think the best illustration is like trying to walk on a knife's edge. It's really easy, even with good intentions, to walk off the edge of it and for things to go bad really quickly. We have these terms like righteous anger. I think often righteous anger is kind of the term we slap on whatever anger we have to justify it. So think about it, like at least if you're anything like me, what usually happens in a situation that makes you angry, something triggers the anger. You follow that emotion, so you lash out in anger. And then, after that emotion has been displayed, your rational thinking kicks in, and you begin to rationalize why you're angry. So like those kids, they were out of control upstairs in their bedroom, and they deserve that tongue lashing, right? I mean, I've told myself many times, and I've told this to my wife. My wife's looking at me like, really? Was that necessary? I'm like, of course it was necessary. And then, like, I'll do that for like a half an hour or an hour, and then at a certain point, it's like, that was ridiculous. That was absurd. Like, that level of anger was totally out of line for what the reality that was happening. But we're so good, we want to slap the label righteous anger on whatever anger we have because we're trying to rationalize how we acted. So how do we handle this emotion? Let me just offer a few ideas. I don't think these will be earth-shattering, but let me just see if I can offer some ideas. One is that acknowledge that the anger is a natural feeling. Like I said, I think that's why I wanted to just kind of rest in this idea that anger is a natural passion. It does not work well to just suppress your anger. So I've met people who all their anger comes out, you know, and that's not good. I've also met people that seems like anger has been building for years and years and years. And it does not seem to be healthy. One, it can build up to the point where the pressure just pops and then it all comes out at once. But often then that anger turns inward. When that anger turns inward rather than being expressed, it leads to bitterness, and often sometimes depression. So one of the most helpful things I think we have here is that we have the Psalms. So if you read through the Psalms, sometimes people read a psalm a day, some of them will be these beautiful psalms that you heard as a kid and they're very happy, and some of them will be downright terrifying. Like Psalm, I think it's 137, talks about the heads of infants being dashed into the rocks. Okay, it is shocking. Like if you've been raised with a certain idea of what the Psalms are and you come to this, you're like, what is going on? But what's happening is that they are expressing their bitterness in this particular psalm for being captives in Babylon, and they are expressing it to God. They're not acting out, heads of infants into rocks, but they're expressing the anger that they've had from this captivity. And I've tried to say this a few different times in different sermons. Like, we worship a God with very broad shoulders. Like, God can take our anger. God can take these raw emotions and he can weave them into his purposes. So one of the ways that we have to deal with anger is in conversation with God, in corporate prayer, in church. Like we are given permission at times, and this isn't all of our worship, to be angry at the injustices of the world and the injustices of our life. I was talking to someone during Ralph's funeral last week, and the person was just reflecting on, in this particular funeral, we were celebrating just a really long, full life with Ralph. And that was all, and if you were at the funeral, you saw that. It was lots of memories and celebration. It was quite beautiful. That's not always the case with a funeral. And this person was reflecting to me on another funeral that they'd been to when someone's life had ended way too prematurely. And they said at that funeral, what was most felt was just anger. But see, the anger was placed within the body of Christ as a way of expressing itself, of saying, this is an injustice. This person did not have a full life like we had hoped. There's an injustice, but there's given space to express that injustice. So we can express our anger to God. I think that's an important thing to recognize. Second, we need to recognize that anger tends to blind us. As I said, we are always tempted to see ourselves as right, as being in righteous anger. One of my favorite quotes is actually a secular quote from Aristotle. I think it gets, though, how we should express anger. Aristotle says, anybody can become angry, that's easy, but to be angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time for the right purpose and in the right way, that's not easy. So lashing out at someone is the easiest thing you can do, and it's a kind of a relief, releasing steam off yourself. But trying to do this in the right way with the right person in the right way, that takes skill. And one of the things that we need to do is often give ourselves space from the incident that triggers that anger to when we actually address what happened. And essentially like time to cool off. And typically what happens when you give yourself some space is, like I said, that outburst of anger at the moment, which seemed completely rational, you look back, and if you can, as much as you can, try to watch it through like an unedited lens, like what was actually happening, it looks kind of ridiculous. So you've given that anger some time to cool off, where you can now, in a more healthy and better way, express why you're angry. The other thing that anger does is it gives us a chance to reflect on what is actually behind that anger. So sometimes someone has done something to us that is deeply hurtful, that has nothing to do with us, and that needs to be addressed, like I said, in a healthy way. Like you can see in the church, we're not told to avoid conflict. But a lot of times, if we're honest with ourselves, often what's behind that anger is wounded pride. So one of the descriptions I thought was a helpful one about anger was that the person compared it to kind of a wounded animal in a corner who feels threatened. So kind of think about that image. At that point, the animal's been wounded, and they were lashing out because they're scared and they're threatened. And a lot of times, I think our fragile egos have been hurt by something. And what it helps us to recognize is that we probably have an overinflated view of ourselves. And I think two things like help with that. One is to laugh at yourself. Like most people, I really admire people who just, like when they recognize that they've been ridiculous, are just able to laugh at themselves. Because what they've done is they've recognized my ego is kind of overinflated there. My ego is kind of ridiculous there. And you notice something, and I'm going to laugh at it too. I know that's not easy, but often we are able to laugh at ourselves the more secure we become in ourselves. And this is where I think this is really key to us as Christians. Where does our security lie? Our security and our deepest identity lies with Jesus Christ, lies with God. It's not that we don't still want to protect our egos, but if that's our deepest identity, we're able to much more step outside of this and laugh, one, at our quirks and our idiosyncrasies, because our trust is in the assurance and love of God, not in our fragile ego that's been triggered. So those are techniques I think someone who's not a Christian could possibly do, but I think we have, as Christians, two really helpful things that we can do in the face of anger. And the first is that we are taught as Christians that we release judgment and the righting of wrongs to God. So as we talked about probably about a month ago in Romans 12, or maybe 2 months ago, vengeance is not ours. Like, ultimately, we don't have the responsibility to right every wrong in the world, to mete out punishments. That's God's responsibility. And that is a utterly freeing thing for us if we can rest in that. That it's not up to us to find every little injustice in our lives or in the world and met that out. Again, that doesn't mean we don't fight against injustice, but ultimately we release that to God. Because that's what vengeance really is. Vengeance is saying, I know how to right what is wrong. And the problem is we cannot be trusted to do that. We are not all loving, we are not all wise like God, and so we release that judgment to God. And I think one of the best kind of object lessons that I've thought about this, it comes from The Lord of the Rings. I think it's in the books. I know for sure it's in the film, but there's this scene where, so if you don't know, the ring, which is worn in The Lord of the Rings, is this thing that gives all this power to someone. But almost nobody can actually wear the ring, because as soon as you put it on, the power begins to corrupt you. You cannot handle the power as a human. And so there's this scene where these two kings, Elrond and Isildur, if you're a Lord of the Rings person, I'm sorry if I butchered that. And they go into the heart of Mount Doom. So Mount Doom is the place where this all-powerful ring was forged. And it's the one place where the ring can be destroyed. And there in the heart of the Mount of Doom, Elrond says to Isildur, cast it into the fire. Destroy it. Elrond knew that the power in the ring was treacherous and could not be handled by men. And Isildur says, no. So even though its power is ultimately destructive, he can't let it go. I think this is an amazing illustration for revenge. Revenge is like this ring that we wear that we think we can control, but we cannot control it. It will eventually corrupt us, and so we release it into the fires of Mount Doom. We release it into an all-loving, all-wise God, trusting that he is the only one who can handle it, the only one that can handle judgment. And secondly, as Christians, we look to the example of Jesus Christ. There was one person who walked on earth who was equipped to handle revenge, and that was Jesus Christ. So we saw earlier in our passage in Mark, the anger towards Jesus was starting to build in this story. They were already starting to plot Jesus' death. And that anger would just build and build by a certain segment of the population until it was finally unleashed on Jesus in his final few days on earth. And as things are moving there, as the anger is building and building, the injustice and the wrath is being unleashed on Jesus, Peter sees what's happening in the garden. And anger springs up in Peter, and he wants to right that wrong. What does he do? He pulls the sword. And Jesus says, put your sword back. Jesus says, don't you realize that I have 12 legions of angels, 72,000 angels that stand behind me just waiting for the order to end this injustice? But that's not what I came to do. So if there was ever a moment when wrath would have been justified to decimate an enemy, to decimate an injustice, it was at that moment. The Son of God, a sinless, perfect, all-loving person, was about to experience the greatest injustice ever done. And what does Jesus do? He is the only one that can perfectly enact revenge. He has 72,000 angels behind him, waiting at his command to end this injustice. What does he do? He takes the injustice himself. He takes it on the cross. He takes all that wrath, all that hate, all that sin in the world, and he bears it. And he forgives those who are doing it to him. This is our supreme example. We forgive. We release our anger. We release our right to punish because we have ultimately been forgiven and released through Jesus Christ. Amen.